I'm going to open this evening's talk with a statement that I guarantee every one of you, young people and adults alike, is going to find shocking. And once I go on, you'll see that the actual way in which I mean this statement is not so shocking, and I think you'll actually come to agree with it. But the statement itself at first will sound jarring. And that is that I think every one of you students in the room here should consider dropping out tomorrow. Now, obviously, I don't mean that in a literal sense. If I did, I think that Sadhana and Andrew and Joanne would get fired tomorrow as well. So what the heck do I mean by that? So I've been spending the day here in this lovely campus. I've never been here before. And I've had a wonderful day. I've spoken with students. I've spoken with faculty. And one of the messages I've heard from various people, students and faculty, is that there's a kind of track going on here that's not unique to Dartmouth, but is maybe pronounced here. And that is a track of doing well in school, then coming here, doing well at Dartmouth, and then going to a quote-unquote respectable profession. So the professions I've heard that are really popular here are management consulting and investment banking, and also law. So the kind of picture I've gotten is a picture of a place where young people from a young age are brought on a track and then kind of put into a tracked career. And I'm not trying to single out Dartmouth here. I went to Brown, so it's pretty much the same thing. We have slightly different relationship to conventionality there, but it's, you know, most of the people are still going into these kind of traditional careers, and they're being groomed for that. And so what I mean when I say that you should consider dropping out is not that you should consider dropping out of this institution. Please don't consider that. But I do think you should consider dropping out of that track. I'm not saying all of you should drop out of the track, but what I hope to accomplish by the end of this evening is to instill in some of you a broader perspective on the range of things that's possible for you to do after you leave this institution and still allow you to lead a happy, comfortable, successful life. So before I go any further, I just want to point out, I don't have anything particular against management consultants and lawyers and investment bankers. Of course I don't. I am using a computer that probably required a lot of investment to make that Apple computer. I'm wearing a suit that probably was made by a company that required lawyers and investors and all those kind of things. So society needs those kind of people, and we need doctors and we need lawyers. So if any of you in the room, and when I say you, I'm mostly speaking to the students here. If any of you students in the room really, really feels called to one of those professions, if you just are one of those people that always wanted to be a doctor and you've dreamed about that since you were a kid, if you're one of those people who always wanted to be a lawyer and you dreamed about that since you were a kid, if you're one of those people who always wanted to be a deal maker and out on Wall Street and wining and dining clients and making deals, then by all means, follow your dreams. However, I speak to a lot of young people. You're not the first audience of young people I've spoken to. And what I find is majority of people who are considering those professions, but a minority of them who are considering it seem to have any idealism about it whatsoever in the way I just described. I don't meet that many people who have a really idealistic conception of why they want to go into law, or a really idealistic conception of why they want to be a doctor or an investment banker. Instead, what I meet a lot of is people who seem to be going through the motions. It just seems that that's kind of the thing you do, especially if you come from a fairly privileged background and if you have access to privileged institutions like Brown or Dartmouth, and you invest a lot of money in your education, it's sort of the thing you do. And a lot of that thinking comes from the idea that that is actually the thing you do if you want to live a materially comfortable life. So my goal is to just broaden your perspective and suggest that there are actually other paths you could take in life, paths that don't involve dropping out of the institution, but do involve dropping out of that really narrowly defined career track that will allow you to live the life you want to live. And I think I'm a pretty good person to speak about that because I just spent 2 years interviewing people who literally dropped out of college and then went on to find their own path and became successful entrepreneurs. I interviewed about 50 self-made millionaires and about 5 self-made billionaires. Some of them are famous. I heard that the movie The Social Network was just played last night here. Has anyone seen The Social Network here? So I interviewed Sean Parker, who was played by Justin Timberlake. He didn't even drop out of college. He didn't go. He has a high school education, and he made his way through the world and in a very interesting way. And he, for better or worse, massively disrupted the music industry with Napster and then massively disrupted our entire social lives and how we spend every minute of our day with Facebook. And now he's doing the same with Spotify. So here's a character who just found his own way through life and didn't really follow any of the tracks that his parents or society might have set for him. And again, I'm not saying all of you should do this, but I want to suggest that some of you should consider taking a less tracked path. I interviewed a ton of people like that in this book. I interviewed Matt Mullenweg, who's the founder of WordPress. How many people here are bloggers or have a blog? By the way, I think all you students in the audience should be blogging now. I think it's a great way to start interfacing with the world that exists outside when you graduate. So here's a guy who created software called WordPress that now 27% of the internet runs on WordPress. I mean, this guy has a massive impact on the world, and he just found his way to do that. And I think that each and every one of you sitting here has the potential to have a massive impact on the world through a path that you create, not a path that was created for you. So as I go on, I want to make a distinction between two kind of extremes with which I tend to see people, and especially young people, navigate towards when they're figuring out which way, how they want to relate with the world of work. And you all, hint, hint, are much closer to one of these extremes than the other. So the two extremes that I see out there are what might be caricatured as the suits and the hippies. The suits and the hippies. And this is actually a distinction that one of my mentors named Brian Franklin came up with, and he's someone who I think integrates these two worlds really well, and I'm going to be telling you about them and how you might integrate them. So let's talk about the suits. And if you could guess, you know, of which one of those two poles, probably someone who's at an elite educational institution tends towards, right? It's the suit. So the kind of stereotype of the suit is someone who kind of plays it safe and narrow, kind of follows the rules that their parents and society sets forward for them, learns how to navigate the institutions within them, that are around them, doesn't really rock the boat too much, but learns how to kind of make their way through the halls of power, and they get rewarded pretty well for that. And all of you could absolutely have that life. And you're on track, my guess, is to have that life. You're already in one of the most elite educational institutions in the world. And provided you don't party too much and you kind of maintain a decent grade average, you're going to graduate with a diploma from here. And that lifestyle is absolutely open to you. You can go and live that kind of suit lifestyle. And there's nothing wrong with that if that's what you want to do. It offers a certain amount of economic stability, which is probably why most of your parents push you to get into an institution like Dartmouth, and why they would like you, my guess, is to become, your parents would like you to become an investment banker or a lawyer or a doctor, because you're gonna, there's a certain predictability to the income you're gonna have with that path. So that's fine. The problem with people who go fully in that path without thinking about it too much, without questioning it too much, is what could be colloquially referred to as the midlife crisis. So you're going along, you went through your entire educational system to get your entire high school system to get here to Dartmouth. You work hard to get your GPA, to get your resume looking good. I hear that it's recruiting season, so you've got the investment banks coming to seek you out. And you go and you do your summer internship there, and you go and you become investment banker, and you work 100 hours a week, and you get paid really well, and you party with your investment banker friends, and you keep getting raises, and maybe you start with an opening salary. I don't know what the opening salaries are these days, but maybe it's 75 or 100, and then in a couple years you're at 200, and then if you really work the system, you could get up to 500 or a million, and all this is going great, except some not insignificant portion of the people who do that track wake up at some point in their life, usually somewhere around midlife in their 40s, and they realize that they were asleep. And then actually they haven't really made any choices about who they are and what they want to be in this world. They've just sort of followed what was set out for them by their parents and by the social circles they were in. And that's when you get all kinds of weird behavior from people. That's people get divorced, they go into, well, that's not weird in and of itself, but you know, people, you know, have these life changes. They get divorced, they go to psychotherapy, they become a life coach. You know, they do something to kind of get out of that system. And usually that involves moving some direction towards the other pole, which I've caricatured as the hippie pole. And I was much more in my 20s towards that pole. So I went through the system. I did well in high school. I went to Deerfield Academy. I did very well academically there. I went to Brown, Phi Beta Kappa, did well there, graduated, class of 1999. And I spent most of my 20s totally lost in trying to figure out how to integrate the kind of tracked system I had been put through and willingly chose to go through in my teens and early 20s, how to integrate that with what felt meaningful to me. So I was kind of lucky or unlucky, depending on how you look at it, and I had my midlife crisis kind of early. I had it about my entire 20s. Were a midlife crisis. And I was very lost. And I knew that I was passionate about writing. I knew that I was passionate about social questions and the environment and literature and philosophy and all these things that lit my brain on fire and my soul on fire. And I just didn't know how to integrate those with actually receiving a check. So part of my 20s involved moving back with my parents, which is not such an uncommon phenomenon now. I read a statistic recently that 85% of recent college graduates are moving back with their parents. So there's clearly some problem our society has with how to raise young people into independent adults who can exist outside the orbit of their parental support systems if 85% of young people, including me, are going right back to that parental orbit system as soon as we got out. There's something wrong there. And as I was trying to figure this stuff out, I kind of went more and more into the hippie direction. And the way I define the hippie direction is it's the exact polar opposite or inverse of the suit. It's focus on meaning, focus on what is going to be meaningful in my life without much attention to how am I going to pay the bills. So in the way that expressed itself through my life was I was very passionate about writing, and I spent several years writing what I hoped would be this groundbreaking literary work of fragmentary manic nonfiction, which didn't have a big market for it, and got rejected 22 times by the New York publishing industry. The most harsh rejection I got, which I'll always remember, was from a major literary editor, and he read my manuscript, which was submitted by my literary agent, and said, he wrote this to my agent, he said, "I'm going to pass on this project. Mr. Ellsberg's writing is simply not strong enough to make up for the fact that he is not a very likable person." So I was a bitter, angry, wannabe artist. I was the epitome of the starving artist. I wasn't literally starving. And the only reason I wasn't literally starving is because I had very generous parents with a generous basement. And so that's what happens when you go in the hippie side too much and you just say, oh, I'm just going to do what feels meaningful to me, and I'm not going to pay attention to how that interfaces with society at large, how that interfaces with markets, with money, and with existing institutions and existing spheres of power. So obviously what I'm encouraging and what I spent the latter half of my 20s, I'm 35 now, what I spent about the last, 7-8 years trying to figure out is some integration between those two. Some integration that allows us to express what is meaningful to us so that we're not at risk for waking up one day when we're 45 and thinking, oh my gosh, what am I doing with my life? What does this all mean? Yet, which also allows us to live a materially comfortable lifestyle. Not necessarily a wealthy or extremely wealthy lifestyle, but a lifestyle where you're not worried about money that much. That's not the main focus of your life. You've got that handle and you can worry about other things like how to express yourself, how to be a contribution to your community or to society at large. And that's been the focus of my life, personally and the way I think, for the last 7 or 8 years, and specifically the last 2 years as I was writing this book here. So this book, it's called The Education of Millionaires. And the people that I interviewed all have one thing in common, besides being dropouts. They have one thing in common, which is that they're entrepreneurs. And I think the path in society that offers the best shot at what I'm talking about, the best shot at integrating the hippie in the suit, the best shot at integrating what you care about and what you're passionate about with what will actually allow you to live a comfortable lifestyle is entrepreneurship. I'm a passionate, passionate believer and supporter of entrepreneurship for young people and for everyone. We have a jobs crisis in America right now. Unemployment is at record highs in the recent history. The unemployment among young people who have college degrees but are under 25, I just read a New York Times article citing this statistic, 20%. 20% unemployment for people who have college degrees and are under 25. The Great Depression was 20% unemployment overall. So right now we're actually in a Great Depression for college-educated young people. There's an article I open with some shock, and I'll continue a little bit of shock. There's an article I read from one of our nation's most reputable news sources, The Onion. And The Onion tells us, new college graduates to be cryogenically frozen until job market improves. They have an infographic that says hiring freeze. So that's, you all are graduating into a very different climate than when I graduated. I graduated in 1999. Those were the go-go days. 1999, you could have the most harebrained idea and someone wanted to give you $10 million to execute it. And you could just show up on the doorsteps of Silicon Valley with a college degree and be hired by some pets.com that was funded by tons and tons of venture money and was trying to spend that money as fast as possible on the growth of the company. That was the environment I graduated in. Of course, that all popped in 2001. Then it went up a bit in the middle of the 2000s. And now we're in a pretty harsh place for young people. It is not pretty what is facing all of you out there. Now, I think you all in this room have a better shot than the average young people in America being here at Dartmouth. And probably if you try hard, you're going to avoid that cryogenic freezing and you're going to avoid the having to move back with your parents and that whole complex. But still, it's tooth and nail right now. And you're probably feeling that competition for the limited job spaces that are coming here recruiting. So what I want to suggest is that some percentage of you, I don't know exactly what that percentage is, but it's not 0% and it's not 100%. Some percentage of you should consider dropping out of the track of fighting with each other for the pre-existing jobs that the management consultants want to give you and actually becoming not seekers of jobs, but creators of jobs. And it's actually, that sounds very grandiose, creating a job. I'm a job creator. I'm self-employed. I have no employees. So how am I a job creator if I have no employees? Well, I created one job for myself. So I created one job, and all of you in this room, I honestly believe this, if you wanted to do it, could create a job for yourself, straight out of college. That path is open to you. It's especially open to you given that you're bright and motivated and have connections, which I know is the case because you're here at Dartmouth. And I was having a really interesting conversation with Andrew, the director of the center here, just before I came here. And he had a quote that I loved. I'm going to just shamelessly steal it from him with credit. Let me just find it here. Andrew, you're in the room? Okay, he had to go. So, Andrew, the director of the center here, said, the entrepreneurship recruiters don't come to campus. The entrepreneurship recruiters don't come to campus. So what does he mean by that? There's a lot of startups out there that are looking for talent. There's a lot of dynamic, interesting, small companies that are dying for the kind of talent that you all have in this room. There's actually a talent shortage among the entrepreneurship world. I know that surprises you because there's all this talk about the lack of jobs and the cryogenic freezing of the job market, but actually in a certain segment of the economy, there's actually a shortage of talent, and that segment is the entrepreneurship segment. But here's the secret, here's the secret key. Those people are not interested in you if they have to come to you to find you. Management consultants, they've got a whole track. They've been doing this for decades. They know how to take raw talent, such as yourselves, give them 75 or 100 grand a year in New York City, and over several years, turn them into management consultants. It's sort of like the army for management consultants. They can take pretty much anyone who has a pulse and turn them in, and is reasonably intelligent, and turn them into a management consultant. And I'm not trying to diss management consulting. At the elite levels, you have to be as smart as any other career I'm talking about here to go there. But what's different about those careers and entrepreneurial careers is that those careers basically select for people who are reasonably good at following orders. And no offense to anyone in this room, because I was a product of the same system, when you go through our educational system in America, especially at the more elite levels, as we did, or we are doing, you basically are being selected for and trained to follow orders. Not on a micro level. I'm not saying that your teachers and professors are telling you what to think. Of course not. I had lunch with several of your professors here, and they wish that you would think outside the box more. Your professors are dying for your creativity. I talked to a bunch of them at lunch. So it's not on the level of your thoughts that they want you to order, that follow their orders. But there's just a general kind of falling in line that happens to get through our educational system, where you sit in class. I mean, just think of the act of sitting in class, right? I mean, a kid is 6 years old, you know, especially a boy, has got all this like energy, and they want to go hit things and punch things and run around, you know, and there's these kids who have all this creative energy, and they're told and trained to sit there in class. And then it becomes more subtle as you go through high school and college, but then in high school, there's basically a way of following orders, and you do well on the SAT, and you do these sort of narrowly defined extracurriculars like Glee Club and, you know, student newspaper. And then in college, there's a certain version of following orders, but it's basically training you to kind of fit in bureaucratic systems where there's hierarchies of authority. In school, it's a teacher student. In a workplace, it's the boss employee. There's these sort of levels of authority, and you kind of get gold stars or A's or 98%, depending on how well you interpret what your authority figure wants and deliver that to them. So that works for a certain segment of the economy. And again, I'm not trying to diss that segment. I'm very happy that there's a lot of middle managers at Apple who produced that laptop that I use. But who created Apple? Who created Apple? This thing was created, this company was created by a guy who dropped out of Reed College, hung around the campus without being a student, illegally took classes without paying for them and being enrolled, calligraphy classes, not business classes, calligraphy classes, then decided that he wanted to go explore India. That decision came, we now know from his biography, after dropping large amounts of LSD, went to India, searched for a guru, and then in all kinds of ways just created his own path. Now, I'm not recommending dropping out of Dartmouth. I'm not recommending dropping LSD or going to search for your guru in India. But metaphorically, I am recommending that. Metaphorically, I'm recommending that some percentage of you don't try to be the kind of middle-of-the-road programmer that's sort of doing the mid-level work to produce these things, or the middle-level middle manager who's doing the kind of bureaucratic paper shuffling to get this thing produced. The people who create those things, Steve Jobs, the people who create Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg and a bunch of other people, Sean Parker, the people who create Microsoft, Bill Gates, the people who own the businesses, not the middle managers of them, the people who create the jobs, tend to be either literal dropouts, which is a minority, but more likely a metaphorical dropout, which means they didn't go through the system. You don't see a lot of MBAs as CEOs, right? The MBAs tend to get hired by the CEOs, but if you look at the CEO, to get to that level of leadership, usually you forge your own path. And they didn't just go through the systems that were in place for them, because by definition, a leader cannot be someone who just follows orders. If the leader had to follow orders, who would they follow orders from, right? The leader is the one who, not necessarily giving the orders, but is creating the culture where the direction of the institution or organization or business is going. So by definition, the leader is not following someone else's path, but is clearing path, is path brushing. And that's a very different skill set than following someone else's path. And you can do that here at Dartmouth. And you can do that when you graduate from Dartmouth. The way you would do it here at Dartmouth, and I'm going to say something now which may piss off some of the adults in the audience, but that's okay because I'm here to talk to the kids. Most of the economic benefit that you will derive from having gone to Dartmouth has already been achieved merely by the fact that you got in, and by the fact that if you don't party too much and don't go over Animal House style and stay, you know, in a reasonable range of grades, you're going to get a diploma. Most of the economic benefit of your time here was already achieved by getting in, and then your chance to get a diploma by kind of just getting B's and getting a diploma with B's. So does that mean that I think you should just slack off and get B's and C's? No, of course not. They wouldn't have me here speaking if that was my message. I believe that now that you already have that benefit of your diploma that says, it's like your societal stamp of approval. This is a smart kid who knows how to fit in, knows how to follow orders, knows how to fit in with, plays well with others, knows how to fit in. This is someone we can trust to hire and put into our bureaucratic system. Now that you have that benefit, there's a lot of other benefits you can get while you're here at Dartmouth that have nothing to do with that system. So what am I talking about? Basically, anything that would allow you to practice leadership. Anything that would allow you to practice leadership. And my understanding is that's the mandate of the center here, is to encourage the next generation of leaders. So anything that allows you to think on your feet, to work with other people, to create things, to pitch things, to communicate persuasively about things, to resolve conflicts, to reach out to other groups that may lend you support. The stuff of leadership, the nuts and bolts of leadership, is a non-academic discipline. You cannot learn to be a leader in a class. You just can't. You can learn some interesting things about leadership in a class and from reading books, and I certainly have learned about leadership from reading books, but that's 10 or 20%. 80% of leadership comes from being a leader on the front lines. So my suggestion to you is an encouragement. Now I'm going to give you one exception to what I'm saying here. Actually two exceptions. First exception, if you know in your heart of hearts that you want to go into academia, you want to be a professor, you want to be a research scientist, then this advice I'm giving you is bad advice, and you really do need to focus on academics. Absolutely. Second exception is if you've heard all the stuff I've said about suits and hippies, and you're like, I don't care about a midlife crisis, I want to go into iBanking. This is what I want to do. At the highest levels, it's a very, very competitive field. And it's only gotten more competitive with the retraction in the economy. So if you're set, if I haven't persuaded you here to metaphorically drop out of that track and you want to stay in that track, then you got to stay in the track. And part of the track is getting the highest number on your GPA as possible. If either of those don't apply to you, if you're not set that you want to go into academia as a profession, and you've decided that you don't want to make the compromises necessary to fit into that track to get at the highest levels of investment banking or management consulting or law school, then I would suggest to you that your best educational opportunities now are actually not by bearing down and getting the best possible GPA. I'm not saying cut class, but maybe take a class that is off the beaten path. Take that calligraphy class the way Steve Jobs took. And he talks openly about how influential that class was to him. So take your version of that calligraphy class that has no practical purpose whatsoever, is not monetizable, does not fit in well with what you think an investment banking recruiter would be looking for. Outside of class, and don't approach your classes with the goal of getting the best grades. What do I mean by that? There's a way you can approach a class that's focused on getting the grade, right? Does everyone know what I'm talking about? I certainly remember this from college. And then there's a way you can approach a class where you let the material breathe through you, and you try to get inside the head of the authors you're reading, and you give space to the material you're working with, and you stay up late debating with your dorm friends about the material. And you write papers that aren't designed to please what you think the professor wants to read, but actually indicates your critical engagement with the material. That's actually how I think you should be engaging with your classes. And outside of classes, I think the emphasis here should be on learning to work with your amazing peers. You've got some of the most interesting, bright, motivated peers on the planet here as your peers. And you're going to have more success the more you learn how to work with them. Teamwork is a cliche, but it's also a very difficult thing that takes a lot of practice to learn how to do it right. You got to learn about communication. You got to learn about persuasion. You got to learn about compromise. You got to learn about collaboration. These are things, they're disciplines, just like sociology and economics are disciplines, but they're not academic disciplines. They're practical, street smart disciplines. Has anyone read or heard of the book Outliers by Malcolm Gladwell? So he has a really interesting point in that book, which I quote in my book. And he says that there's a lot of evidence, both empirical and anecdotal, statistical and anecdotal evidence, that once you get past a certain level of IQ, and once you get past a certain level of academic achievement, further improvements in analytic IQ type intelligence and further improvements in academic rigor and achievement actually don't correlate very well to success in the world. And that level is, in IQ, is roughly 120. That's what Malcolm Gladwell says. And that 120 on the scale is called, I can't remember what they call it, but it's like one, it's not even gifted. It's like sort of above average. Same with grades. They did a study of minority law students at the University of Michigan, which is one of our most elite law schools. So minorities at one of our nation's most elite law schools. And what they found is that the minorities tended to have lower test scores coming in and lower grades. And there was a lot of concern about this. Well, here are these minorities who are here, they're getting lower grades, they're going to be less successful when they graduate. But when they went and they had a number of metrics to define success in the legal profession. I can't remember exactly what the metrics were, but they were things like promotions and salary level and different types of metrics as to whether people were successful or not. And what they found was, despite the lower grades at law school, there was no discernible difference in real world life success and happiness with the profession. So the conjecture is that once you're above a certain threshold, like, you don't get into Michigan Law School if you're a moron. You already, there's a presumption that you're a pretty smart cookie if you're getting into the Michigan Law School. Once you're over that threshold, additional grade points aren't going to make that much of a difference in your success. So what does make a difference? Gladwell writes about, and he cites a bunch of experts saying there's a type of intelligence called practical intelligence, which is your leverage point once you're over that threshold of intelligence. So all of you here at Dartmouth are already over the threshold of intelligence for success. Unless you want to be a research scientist or a physicist, which has a much higher bar for analytic intelligence to succeed. Unless you want to go into one of those very, very narrow academic fields, you're already cool in that department. You're set. Now, your success, the lever of your success, the thing you should be cranking on if you want additional success in your life, is what Malcolm Gladwell calls practical intelligence. So what is practical intelligence? Practical intelligence is, as it sounds, it's how to interface practically with the world around you. How do you communicate with other people? How do you persuade other people to your viewpoint? How do you listen to other people's viewpoint and have empathy and understand where they're coming from? How do you inspire other people? How do you motivate other people? How do you manage? How do you manage conflict? How do you understand? How subtle and sophisticated is your level of understanding of power dynamics within a group of people? How do you know how to navigate those power dynamics? How do you read? How do you work a room? These are all the things of, guess what? Leadership. Leadership. That's what this institute is here to promote, are those skills. They're not telling you to drop out of college. Of course not. They're not telling you to give up academic studies. Of course not. But this institute is about leadership, and leadership, the stuff of leadership, is practical intelligence. And so what I hope I've inspired you to do is realize that you've already got enough of the academic smarts. You're good in that department. And that if you start thinking about practical intelligence, if you start thinking about how can I go out and create opportunity for myself? How can I go out and interface my passions, my dreams, my desires with the power structures and the sources of money out there? How can I create opportunity for myself and other people? How can I be a job creator? How can I create one job, a job for myself? What I'm suggesting to you is you can actually bypass this entire collective freak out that young people are having right now about where and how am I going to get a job. Recruiters are here now. Is there a fair amount of tension about like who's going to get to talk to the recruiters and who's going to get which job offer? Right, my understanding talking with a lot of young people is that's pretty salient right now, this fear about there's not enough and we got to fight harder to get those limited opportunities. So what happens is anytime a constriction happens in a system, people fight harder to win in the limited metrics of that system. So there's been a constriction in the path that I've been talking about. There's less corporate law jobs, there's less management consulting jobs, there's less investment banking jobs, there's been a constriction. The people who still want to bust through those gates work harder at the very same metrics they had to use to get in the gates before. So they bear down even harder and take more finance classes and get, you know, one or two GPA percentage points higher, or hundredths of a percent, or whatever they're competing on. And it's like it has a feeling of like a herd stampeding through a bottleneck, where there's just this frenzy to get through this bottleneck. You can opt out of that system. You can drop out, to use a language I've been using, of that system. And in the entrepreneurial world, it's a completely different game. There is so much opportunity right now for people who learn these practical skills. There's a dearth of young people who are able to completely think for themselves, create opportunity for themselves, take initiative, create groups, effectively achieve things through those groups. There's a lack of young people who are really, really good at those things, because our entire educational system views those as extracurricular and therefore less important, and instead trains people to be more and more efficient of getting through the doors of that limited track system that I've been talking about. So I want to close the talk portion of the talk here, and then we're going to go to Q&A, with a website that I think all of you should check out. And it's called workingforwonka.com, workingforwonka.com. And this tagline is surviving a startup. And the basic idea of this website, it's the first one of its kind that I've ever heard of, is basically how do you get a job in a startup? And I'm not talking about these crazy, like Facebook is no longer a startup, right? Google is no longer a startup. So I'm not talking about how do you go to Silicon Valley and get a job at Facebook or Google or Apple, which is more has more in common with the management consulting track than with the entrepreneurial track at this point. This blog is about how do you get a job for Facebook when it was 20 employees? How do you get a job with Google when it was 20 employees? How do you get a job at the next Facebook and the next Google and the next Twitter? And it's a totally different mindset than the one that most of you have been groomed for by your parents. This is a mindset where leadership is prized. Initiative is prized, not following orders. There's, in a startup environment, simply following orders is a liability. They need people who can wear many hats, can think in an innovative way, can generate ideas, can act on those ideas without a lot of guidance and structure. A totally different skill set. And so my suggestion to you is that if you want to opt out of the kind of freak out everyone's happening about how many jobs are there on Wall Street and who can get the limited number of management consulting jobs, there's these green pastures right now. Whoa. That is a sign from somewhere. There's these green pastures, he says as the light turns off, out there that are not only want, but are begging for you to learn this other skill set that centers around leadership. And my hope is that some of you take this message, focus the rest of your time here on becoming outstanding, excellent leaders, and you're going to find that there's a world of economic opportunity available for you. Thank you. So we have time for some question and answer, and I'm going to prioritize questions from students, and then we'll take some questions from some of the adults. So just raise your hand, students, if you have any questions. Any questions from students? See, this is the initiative I'm talking about. Let's get some initiative. Oh, another thing that I didn't talk about as much is risk taking, right? So, okay, we got some risk takers and initiative people back there. Can we get a mic for them, please? Okay.
All right. So my question is, this is just like a little reassurance, and I don't know if there's an answer, but right. I don't want to know my IQ ever. I don't really want to limit myself or define myself in that way.
Right.
But for the, you know, standard level of, you know, academic achievement that you said is necessary, or like all that's necessary and you don't need to go above that point, could we safely assume for the most part that if we got in here we're at least at 120 or
yeah,
just so I don't like, you know,
absolutely
there's a possibility that like, so, I'm an idiot or something.
This is a very,
which I probably am,
anyway. IQ is an extremely controversial topic in America, and I don't want to get too deep into that debate, but one point I want to make is that IQ is very, very correlated with what I would call academic intelligence. So the same kind of intelligence that allows you to do well on an IQ test is highly correlated with the kind of intelligence that allows you to do well on academic tests and you know, write academic papers. It's a kind of analytic intelligence where you're breaking things down, you're analyzing them, you're taking the large and breaking it into pieces and talking about the pieces. You can absolutely assume that, I don't want to put numbers to it, but if you got into Dartmouth, you're cool in that department. Like, don't worry about it. The other kind of intelligence, there's a lot of names for it, but it might be called a synthetic intelligence. There's an analytic analysis and synthesis. So IQ is about analysis. It's about how can you break things down. Synthesis is about how you can take pieces and rearrange them in really interesting ways. How can you take a bunch of different pieces before Apple computers existed and then create an Apple computer out of them? How can you take a bunch of different pieces before smartphones existed and make a smartphone out of them? And that requires a totally different use of your brain than IQ. There's a kind of simplification in our culture around this with left brain and right brain. There's a great book on this called A Whole New Mind, and it's by a guy called Daniel Pink. And if you're concerned about any the question he had, you want to read this book. And he basically argued that is it the left brain is the more analytic one? Is that right? Is that okay? So he argues that our culture up until the last 10 years or so was a culture that rewarded left brain thinking. So it was economic opportunity was provided by large bureaucratic institutions. They like to hire these legions of middle managers who kind of analyze reports, things like that. So the way you got ahead was to develop your analytic thinking, your left brain thinking, through academic means. And his argument is that now a good part of left brain thinking is being outsourced to India and China, is being taken over by software. Like anything where it's like there's decision trees and rules that you follow is being automated, offshored, outsourced, downsized. And the people who are really going to get ahead are the ones who excel in right brain thinking, which is a more synthetic, creative kind of thinking. How do you take different ideas and combine them in interesting ways and create something new? So I would suggest, and I would agree with Daniel Pink, that if you want to do something outside of the tracks that I've been talking about, that you'll actually be better off developing the synthesis type of thinking instead of the IQ type of thinking. Yes?
Yeah, so I know that you're not recommending dropping out, but for the students who are working on a startup, following their vision, and have funding, how do you reconcile studying part-time and also working on the startup part-time? I feel like working on a startup part-time is like a recipe for death.
Yeah. So I've been saying all along, you know, don't drop out. And I think that is true for like 99.9% of the students here. And I also am saying it because I don't want the people who brought me here to be fired. There is a very small minority who I think actually would be better off focusing on a startup. And I would say if you're doing a startup here or in college, and it's not just some pie-in-the-sky, harebrained idea that you've dreamed up in a late-night bull session, but you've actually executed and you have traction with it and you have revenue and you have users, there it may be a valid decision to temporarily see if that is going to be the source of your education. Because a startup can be a wonderful source of education. But you got to, as you say, you got to go in full in. To do a real startup, you can't really do it in a half-assed way. It's a full-in commitment. So I actually interviewed Dustin Moskovitz, who's one of the co-founders of Facebook, dropped out of Harvard. So he didn't actually drop out at first. This is a legendary story now, but he and his cohort there at Harvard started Facebook. It got massive traction within a few months. They spent the summer out in Silicon Valley, much more traction. And it was clear to them that they were getting way more education doing that than like going back to school and taking tests and things. But the point is, two points. One, they already had traction, so they knew it wasn't just a pie in the sky thing. And two, Dustin told me something really interesting. He said, I didn't drop out right away. I just stopped. I just said, I'm taking a year off or a semester off. And most educational institutions have some tolerance for that. Some tolerance for, hey, I want to explore something else for a year and if it doesn't work out, I'm going to come back. And I think for some minority of students, that is an appropriate decision.
So going back to your story, I guess, and also correlating to Bill Gates, is that both of you didn't start right out of college and suddenly have an idea and go with it. It took a lot of struggle, and he went and did whatever he did, and you said you had your artist crisis. Malcolm Gladwell also said that it takes 10,000 hours of experience before you actually get good at something. So how do we go on a track to get that experience without being on the track?
Great question. The best solution, if you don't want to go on the track that we've been talking about, and you want to have some space in your life to explore creativity, explore passions, while still not living in your parents' basement, you know, while still being able to pay bills, the best solution is a tried and true solution that's been used for decades and maybe even centuries, which is the day job and then the creative passion on the side. So if I'm a writer, for example, it's very hard to get paid as a writer off the start. It's almost impossible now. It's gotten harder every year with the proliferation of free content. I happen to make a living now as a writer. I'm not going to get super wealthy from it, but I support myself in New York City as a writer. That didn't happen. I'm 35 now. That didn't happen when I was a wannabe writer at 25. So I had to do other things that weren't writing to pay the bills. Or actually, I'll take that back. They were writing, but they were a form of writing that was less creative, but more likely to earn me money. So my general talent area has always been around words and persuasion through words. That actually is a talent that can be monetized fairly well if you're willing to help other people market their businesses through words, for example, or copywriting, or writing proposals. So I had my day job form of writing, which was writing proposals and things that I wasn't going to, you know, wake up if there wasn't money involved in desire to write a proposal. But because they were paying me, I would do it. And then that gave me the space without a boss, which is a really, really nice thing. If there's any way you can avoid having a boss, I highly recommend it. It's a lovely, lovely thing to not have a boss. And that allowed me to not have a boss, and then it gave me time and space to pursue the writing I was passionate about, and that evolved over time into, I started getting paid more and more for that type of writing over time, and eventually now I'm writing books where I'm making a livable income from writing about things that I'm really passionate about. So that's the model. And there's actually a lot of historical precedent. T.S. Eliot was, I think, a stockbroker or something, and Kafka was an insurance man. So there's this, the starving artist model is just one model. There's people who have been exploring other models about how to support creativity. Yes?
Just going right off of that, for you, it happened to coincide your actual interest, and you were able to make ends meet before you actually got to the point where you wanted to get. What if what you actually want to do isn't able to provide, you know, the sustainable lifestyle, not in your parents' basement? Yeah. Like, what if they don't match up?
So let me ask you, if you're willing to go there, what I sense from your question, there's something you're passionate about that you're not sure if that would make money. Is that true?
Well, the problem is I like a lot of things.
Tell me one thing that you're passionate about that you're not sure could make money.
Well, it's all right, I guess I need this.
Oh wait, pause just one second. Risk taking, super, super high skill for pursuing the kind of stuff I've been talking about. So you're already there. You're just by being the first one to ask a question and sharing something that's kind of personal about yourself, you're already developing risk-taking skills, so kudos to you.
Thank you. I actually kind of disagree, but how do you get to the point where you commit fully. Like, if you're gonna like pull a Zuckerberg and you don't know, yeah, I mean, you don't know. I mean, you can, it could be Facebook or it could be like, you know, broke, or you just, you know, end up working at McDonald's or something. Nothing wrong with that. But I mean, how do you get to the point for risk taking to make a valuable assessment on, you know, this success rate?
I still want to see if I can squeeze out of you one. Like,
right.
What's one thing that you're really passionate about that you're not sure you can make money
okay,
from?
Okay, we'll get to it. Well, I mean, I love academics, and that's kind of my problem too, but I'm from the city as well, and I'm an actor and musician, so, and that's like, you know, the tricky one where, you know, you could be severely successful or working as a waiter, and you don't know what you're going to get.
Yeah. So this is a great question. Okay, acting, acting, and you said acting and music, right? Or okay, great, great question. Okay, and you pointed to something really important: is the more creative a discipline is, the more variance there is in success. People who are successful at that discipline. So let's take a fairly uncreative discipline, relatively speaking. Let's take accounting, right? Even the term account, like if you say like creative accounting, that's an epithet, right? So nothing against accountants, but it's relatively speaking a less creative endeavor. If you go in that field and you satisfy the kind of minimal talent requirements to be an accountant, and you get your base, you get a B from a middling school, and you get your certification or whatever is required, there's not that much variance, relatively speaking, as to success of accountants. There's some accountants that do a bit better. There's some that do a bit worse. There's a bit of variance. But pretty much all people who satisfy the minimum requirements do okay. More creative endeavors are exactly the opposite. More creative endeavors like acting and music, like writing, like entrepreneurship, have a different model where there's a small percentage of people who are wildly successful. They're in acting, it's all the actors you've heard of, you know, Tom Cruise and Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie. And for every one of them, there's like a million people who are actors, quote unquote, who serve you your fries at McDonald's. And same is true of music, same is true of writing. There's a lot of reasons I could go into why those fields are different. There's a great book about this called The Black Swan. Has anyone heard of that book? If you're interested in that topic, you should read The Black Swan. But I won't go into the detail of why that's the case, but let's just say you want to make it in one of these fields where there's a really uneven skew about who's successful and who's not. So let's just say acting, for example. I would say the wrong way to go about it is to try to, within acting, there's a kind of path and then an out-of-the-box way of thinking. So I've been talking overall in society about there's sort of this systematic path, and then there's a more out-of-the-box entrepreneurial way of thinking. That actually is true within each field as well, including each creative field. So let's say you want to be an actor. There's kind of a way that you're supposed to be an actor, right? The way that you're supposed to be an actor is there's basically a New York way and an LA way. Let's just take the New York way, because we're closer to New York. You know, you graduate from a liberal arts college like Dartmouth, or Brown, you move to New York, you move to some, you know, shit apartment, like way out in Brooklyn for, you know, $500 a month, and your housemates are cockroaches and rats. And, you know, you get some waitering or bartending job, and then you go to auditions and you beg, you supplicate for people to give you opportunity. Just as some of your peers are supplicating for the management consulting recruiters to give them opportunity. So the basic assumption is opportunity is given to me and I beg for it. And that exists in each field. So Jess says I'm encouraging you all to consider a more entrepreneurial approach to your careers. If you specifically want a more risky career, like acting, like music, like writing, I would suggest you take an entrepreneurial attitude to that. So you think, okay, I'm passionate about acting. How can I create some opportunity around me that involves acting, that gets me paid reasonably well, that connects me to the right people to in the acting world, and that gives me some flexibility and freedom to pursue my more avant-garde tendencies, which probably won't get paid. So there's all kinds of things you could do. I just met a woman who is an actor and a stand-up comic. It's extremely hard to make a living as a stand-up comic through the track of stand-up comedy. The track is you travel around the country, you go to a bunch of free open mics, you hope that someone gives you opportunity, you work your way up the system, and maybe 1/1000th of 1% of the people actually make their living from it. Well, this woman was passionate about comedy, knew she wanted to devote her life to it, didn't want to take that roll of the dice, which was very unfavorable. So she started teaching stand-up to CEOs. She's like, look, you guys have to be on your feet all day long. You need to learn how to think on your feet. And you guys are leaders. You need to have some comic relief in your leadership so that it's not so stuffy and dry what you're doing. And this woman is making a lot of money teaching improvisational comedy to CEOs and other managers in the corporate world. She gets paid a lot. She doesn't have a boss. And she gets to pursue her more artistically pure endeavors as well because she's around the acting. So that's a basic answer to your question. Okay, let's take from an older person.
You've linked entrepreneurship and leadership with practical intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to ask you how much or what component you think sort of ruthlessness comes into it. I've started the fourth volume of Caro's biography of Lyndon Johnson, and recently I haven't read the Jobs biography, but I've read a couple of scathing reviews of his personality
right.
through it. You have this guy in England who is head of Barclays, and he's calling people in the House of Commons committee by their first name. And you have examples like John Edwards and John Kennedy.
Right.
These people are ruthless. They're not nice people.
Yeah.
How much of that comes into play?
That's a great question. So I don't want to assume anything about you because I don't know you, but I would just say in general that question is the kind of way that the people on the hippie side of things think about the people on the suit side of things. So again, I'm not saying anything about you. I'm just saying I've heard that kind of concern voiced by people like me who are the starving artists. Well, it would be nice to have more money, but I got to be an asshole to earn more money, and I don't want to be an asshole, so I'll just be broke. I think that's an incorrect way of thinking. Look at leaders, look at leadership around the world, and there's a spectrum. So on one end of the spectrum is Attila the Hun, and on the other end of the spectrum is the Dalai Lama and Gandhi and Martin Luther King and Mother Teresa. Now, one thing that's really, really, really important to keep in mind is that the Dalai Lama and Mother Teresa and Martin Luther King are actually not saints. We tend to project a lot of saintliness onto them, and then we get really disappointed when they don't act like saints, they act like humans. So, for example, it's widely known that Martin Luther King cheated on his wife and had mistresses. Gandhi was up to some weird things. Like he was like celibate with his wife, but then he slept with nude teenage girls in his bed to like practice his ability to, not avail of himself of his desire. I mean, there was just some weird stuff going on with the guy. And, you know, he's not a saint. He's a human being. But I would say that on the spectrum of leadership, he's much closer to the kind of leadership. I mean, he embodies the best kind of leadership that's possible for humans, which is a leadership that is about taking opposing sides and finding a better synthesis from them. So I think that's what all those leaders on this side did, is they weren't just this ruthless, like, kill your enemy mentality, but instead were leaders by saying, we're going to overwhelm our opponents by such extreme power of our soul and our love that we'll actually not only bring them over to our side, but we're actually going to learn something from them, and we're going to find a better, more inclusive synthesis. And that's an ideal, but it's a great ideal, and certain leaders have embodied that ideal. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just wanted to make a pitch for the liberal arts here, because in a startup particularly, or smaller businesses, a leader has to do pretty much everything. You get to be a lawyer for half an hour a day. You have to write. You've got to manage personnel. You have to have taste in looking at your advertising, deal with people. It's a whole broad range of things. And if you come to school like this and you take 14 courses in economics and the rest in math,
yes,
you know, subject to distributive requirements and all, you're missing out on really a whole broad range of experiences that you can get here, which will help you in the future. So I guess, you know, your
great
sense of the liberal arts.
Absolutely. So I've talked about two ways you can avoid this. I'll just call it the track, for lack of a better term, the track that's going to get you right into a 100-hour-a-week management consulting job. By the way, I'm going to answer your question in just 1 second. Just one little kind of warning. Oh, thank you. One little warning about that track that I've seen, that I've never, ever, ever seen said elsewhere, is that part of what is enticing you to go on that track is the money, right? I mean, you probably wouldn't be doing all this stuff if they were paying $30,000 a year or something like that. It's that you earn a lot of money when you go on that track. And this, what are the starting salaries these days for management consulting? Is it like 75 or 100, something like that? That's good money. But here's the thing. Let's say it's $100,000 starting salary. It's actually not one full-time job for $100,000. It's actually two 40 or 50-hour-a-week jobs for $50,000 each. So if someone were to offer you one job for $50,000, you'd be like, I don't want that. It's just $50,000. But when they offer you two jobs for $50,000 times two, you're like, great, where do I sign up? And then you get totally burned out working 100-hour weeks, and eventually you fizzle out. And a lot of those people end up using drugs to get through the day, cocaine, Adderall, all kinds of stuff. They're so, like, wired up from their 100-hour weeks that they just drink themselves to oblivion when they get off work. It's not a pretty system. So, okay, back to your question. So I've been saying, if you want to opt out of that system, or drop out, as I've been saying in quotes, of that system, there's two aspects to it. It's how you relate to your courses and how you relate to your time here outside of your courses. And let's just say you're going to have a 50-50 balance between the courses and the time outside of the courses. The people who are on the track, they mostly have like an 80-20 balance, or a 90-10 or a 100-0 balance between academics and courses. But let's just say you're going to do 50-50. My argument is, the part that's the 50%, that's your classes, take an entrepreneurial approach to that as well. And by entrepreneurial, I mean try lots of different stuff. Seek out those kind of quirky professors who you're really never going to get a chance to study from again. You don't find those quirky professors usually in, you know, teaching accounting and finance. You find them, these are people who have devoted their lives to the life of the mind. And you tend to find those kind of people in philosophy classes, in anthropology classes, in literature classes. So seek those people out, because once you're already here, unless you're trying to do that track, how you do in your classes grade-wise and which classes you take are not going to have that much of a bearing on your success. When I pitch a client on some kind of freelance writing job, I've never been once asked what my GPA was. If you go through this more entrepreneurial path that I've been talking about, they're not going to ask or care very much about which college you went to or your GPA. Let me be clear about that. If you want to get an entry-level job at Apple, they're going to be very concerned with which college you went to and what your GPA is. But that is not an entrepreneurial job. Apple is not a startup anymore. Neither is Facebook, neither is Google. If you want to get a job at a real bona fide startup that has 5 employees or 10 employees or 20 and they're growing fast, they're really not going to give a darn or very little of a darn what your GPA was. And they're going to give a lot more of a darn what your speaking skills are like, how you collaborate with other people, what your portfolio of results you've achieved already are. So there's all these metrics that you can excel at that actually have nothing to do with grades. How's our time here? Do we have time for a couple more? Okay, I'll just keep going until you guys leave or they cut me off. So, yes, back there. Yeah.
This is another one for those of us who are over 35. I'm a 1984 graduate of the college.
Yeah.
I've worked in academia, business, and government. From your conversations, your interviews with the successful entrepreneurs,
yeah,
what pearls of wisdom have you gained for those of us who are over 35?
Yeah. Great. Is your question more tailored towards how you could possibly get involved with a startup or more excel in your employment?
No, at this point, no. I worked for a startup during the internet bubble in the Boston area, which went belly up 2001. I've had 2 sole proprietorships. I do intercultural training, but I work mainly as an Italian and Portuguese medical interpreter, self-employed. What I was hoping to hear tonight is ways that I could not necessarily become a millionaire, but how could I find more steady employment, given that I have a family, I've got a small child, something for somebody who has over 20 years of experience.
Right.
Is there something that you heard from your interviews? Since I haven't read your book yet, I don't know.
Yeah. There's a one-word answer to your question, and then I'll give you a more detailed answer. The one-word answer is sales. Every one of these people, almost every one of them, had some experience in their early days where they got really good at selling stuff. Because if you have services that you're selling, if you're trying to sell yourself to an employer or if you're trying to sell yourself to clients, like the first point of contact that someone who might give you money is going to have with you is through your sales process. Either you're selling them to be a client or a job interview, which is a form of sales. So the leverage point, I'm already going to assume that you're good at what you do. And so, because you've been doing it for 20 years, your leverage point is not to get better at that. And it's definitely not to get more certifications in that thing. This is the number one mistake I see, is that people get kind of stuck in their career. Let's say someone has a bachelor's degree, and they go along, and they're doing okay, and then they kind of get stuck in their career. The number one thing they think to do when they get stuck is what? Go back to school. If you got a BA, get a master's or an MBA. If you got a master's or an MBA, get a PhD or a second MBA or a second master's or a third master's. That is diminishing returns, because the thing that is impacting your practical success in the world, and specifically how much people are willing to pay you, is actually not increases in your certification or your talent. You're already good enough. It's sort of like the IQ thing. You're already good enough. The leverage point now is learning sales, learning how to communicate persuasively about what you do. And I don't mean in a sleazy way. I have a whole chapter about how sales can really be actually a high integrity enterprise.
Actually, I just want to contradict you on that point.
Okay.
In the field of healthcare interpretation, I'm a medical interpreter, so I work in hospitals with Italian and Portuguese speaking patients. Actually, there's a movement towards national certification. So recently, I had to take a test to become nationally certified, even though I've got lots of years of experience doing this.
Yeah.
But this business that I had as an intercultural, what used to be called a cross-cultural trainer, I've worked with a lot of major corporations from Gillette, Bank of America, Philips, Deloitte & Touche, Ocean Spray. In the last few years, I would say probably since 2008 when I started this little company, these companies have decided to cut their budgets for this kind of training. So I find myself doing mostly medical interpreting, but I'm really trying to find a full-time job. And what I do is by no means full-time.
Okay, so my answer to you, so thank you. My answer to you then was a bit off. If you're trying to do freelancing, I would say the sales thing is really important. If you're looking for a full-time job, the one-word answer I would give you instead of sales is networking. That's where your opportunity is. You're probably, I know a business owner who owns a bar in Miami, and he puts out frequently employment ads on Craigslist for bar staff. And these are $8 an hour positions. He'll frequently put out an ad, and he'll get 500 responses, and 80 or 90% of those people have bachelor's degrees applying for an $8 an hour job. So the cattle call kind of herd way to do it that we've been talking about is to bear down, like get more credentials, all that kind of stuff, and then kind of go send out as many resumes as you can and hope that someone will pick you. The more entrepreneurial way to do it is get the certifications you need to practice your job. Like if you want to be a surgeon, you can't get surgeon opportunities unless you have a thing that says you're a doctor. So whatever is the equivalent of in your field, you got to have that. It's like the price of entry. But once you have that, more of those kind of things, more letters after your name and more memberships and various kinds of associations, like that's not where the juice is. The juice is connecting with people in your field, learning how to create opportunity yourself through networks. And I write a lot about that in my book. I think we have time for one more question. One more question. Okay, I'm going to be signing books out there. Thank you all so much. Yeah, thank you.